Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to Stop Hammer Time. The Innocence Project is an organisation dedicated to overturning miscarriages of justice, instances where people have been incarcerated or wrongly accused of things they haven't done. Since their inception in 1992, they've overturned or vacated over 300 verdicts, and now they've taken on Sheffield United. In what could be described as a cold case, over 48 hours ago, Sheffield United were involved in a severe beating. They claim they're innocent, and the Innocence Project has taken their case on. They claim that it was not them that was beaten, but possibly Southampton or Stoke. "We all look the same to them," they say. And the Innocence Project hopes to vacate this miscarriage of justice. If you want to help Sheffield United overcome this terrible slight against them, they have a Kickstarter or GoFundMe, Patreon. They have one of those. Please, please help them to reach the right verdict. Give them their freedom. Here to discuss that beating on Saturday are Jim Grant.
Good evening. Good evening.
Everything all right, Jim?
Yes, very good indeed.
We went to that game.
We did.
Then afterwards, we went and did a music pub quiz.
A music pub quiz.
In Down.
Where
you're from.
Where I'm from.
Where you live.
Yes, not the county Down.
No.
We didn't go from the ground to... No, the village of Down.
All of the questions in County Down would be about Van Morrison. In fact, there was one question about Van Morrison, and we didn't know the answer.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. We didn't know the answer to the question about Van Morrison.
Yeah.
Because it was about his later work, 1995.
Yeah.
Who here knows the Van Morrison 1995 song that became the song of the peace agreement?
Yeah, something like that.
It was like the song of the Northern Ireland peace agreement.
No one knows.
Also here this week, Pete Harcourt is with us.
Good evening, Phil.
Pete, you were there on Saturday.
I was indeed.
Very good result.
It was.
Very good result. We'll get into that in a minute. Also, it is a founder, member of Stop Hammer Time. There at the very first broadcast we did, myself, Jim, and Pete Ward.
Good evening.
Hello, Pete.
How are you doing?
Very well. Good. So, we played Sheffield United on Saturday, and we beat them 2-0. Now, to open proceedings, I'm going to say the atmosphere is quite flat. And there may have been reasons for that atmosphere being somewhat flat, and maybe we'll get into those now.
Train strike.
Less people in the stadium.
But I also think
something about the game.
It was a bit boring.
Well, yes. I didn't think that was true in the first half. But however, I do think that they're a team that were coming off an 8-0 thrashing. There was an expectation that West Ham would beat them comfortably, which then sort of happen.
Yeah.
And then in particular, in the second half, you know, we took our foot off the gas, didn't we? And
you never really got out of second gear, though.
There wasn't a sense that... I mean, the only fear in those situations is that sometimes having taken your foot off your gas, that they get a sneaky goal.
Yeah.
It's hard to put your foot back on the gas. But nevertheless,
there's sort of two ways of looking at that. And Jim, you said both of these things as we were watching the game. We took our foot off the gas in the second half. Given that we were a team that was relegation threatened last year, to the extent that if they'd scored one,
we would have panicked.
Things might have got Areola really hard. You know, Areola had to make some good saves. Had they scored one, we might have been in serious trouble.
It would have been like the Luton game, wouldn't it? The last sort of
comparable, weren't they?
And conversely, the other thing you said is that. The game sort of ended up having a long, long petering tail that lasted 45 minutes. And actually, Man City fans, a lot of the games they watch are like this. They're efficient victories.
Exactly.
That actually then, once they've got the goals they need, they really do take their foot off the gas and just conserve their strength for their Champions League game in the week, you know. So I wonder whether
we save Phil rather than score, are you, against Sheffield United? We thought we'd save some for Freiburg.
So I don't know where the truth lies. You know, I think that we shouldn't be thinking it was a comfortable victory, we can just sort of coast through the rest of the game, given what last season was like. However, maybe we were sort of comfortable. Maybe we did think we were comfortable, and if anything had happened. But the only thing that happened would be a goal.
Yeah.
And then you have to step it up, and you might not be capable of stepping up.
I didn't think there was much chance of Sheffield United scoring. I mean, I know there was one blinded save from Areola point blank, but in most of Sheffield United's attempts at shooting towards the goal, were literally towards our end. They were so wide and so bad.
Yes.
That's why I found the game sort of quite boring in the second half, because their wherewithal tailed off very quickly within 15 minutes of the restart. I thought they felt they really didn't have much chance. We were managing it, and it was a bit like a Manchester City game. Nothing. Go on about that later.
It was. The more I thought about it, the more I leaned towards the fact that it was probably, in the end, decent game management, given that the next two games are probably the crucial group game in the Europa. Win at Freiburg or get something, you know, that probably sets you up for winning the group. I thought they're likely the best team in it apart from us. And then a very difficult game following up on Sunday against Newcastle. You know, you can see that, and as you say, you know, Man City win games like that all the time. They don't always thrash. We could have scored four in the first half.
Yeah.
We could very easily have scored, and then it would have been seen as a drubbing, and it felt like it was going to be that at any point in that first half where we were utterly dominant.
Yeah.
I
think if you look at the stats at the end, stats obviously aren't the be-all and end-all, but it actually finished a lot closer. I think we only had 53% possession, they had
40%.
But I think, on that point, I think there wasn't a lot of difference between Sheffield United and TSK Bakatopola.
No.
In terms of quality of opposition.
No.
No, they were poor. And... you know, hopefully we won't have to think about them after May next year for at least another year, which would be great.
Until the court case happens.
Yeah. I despise them. I think this podcast is more or less established. I hate them. I think I've threatened to fight Sean Bean. We had Ray Winston on this podcast, I made him threaten to fight Sean Bean. I despise them. And Jim, you know, we went to see them, didn't we? Because our friend television producer Caroline Leddy was a Blades fan living in London. We went to see them play.
That's the Charlton. I've been to Charlton. Yeah. I've stood with Sheffield United fans at Crystal Palace. One or two other players, Fulham maybe as well. You know, we have a good friend. Yeah, we had a very good friend who was a Sheffield United fan, and it was all
that friend is dead now. No, I'm saying. Is
that that was all pre Tevez, pre. Well, it must have been.
God knows. Now I want them to do badly in everything they do.
That's
I'm over it.
They're succeeding in that. They're definitely doing badly.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm over it, to be honest.
The goals were good.
The goals were not very well taken.
I tell you what, the Bowen goal. We have scored some cracking goals from open play this season. That Bowen goal was, you know, it was a top notch team move. All on, and you know, on the deck, interchange of passing, movement off the ball, beautiful first time side foot finish.
And it's a turnover of play in both instances. Alvarez, you know, wins, you know, just Alvarez sees a chance, gives it to Souček, who perfectly weighted past a Soufal cross, Bowen goal. Mm. Really, really nice move.
What was quite refreshing about that was also that if Bowen wasn't there, Ward-Prowse was on his right foot.
Yeah,
forward.
He was totally unmarked, Bowen. He just walked into the penalty area and the defence.
Well, he pointed where he was going to go, more or less, didn't he? He was like, he was just on his bike going, me, here.
Passed it into the net, as they say.
Yeah. It's lovely.
But, I mean, that's the great thing about Ward-Prowse is that he really, you know, every department of the kind of midfielder's game, he sees. He sort of sees, he breaks stuff. I mean, actually, when we seemed to be in sort of third gear, it felt that he was still in kind of fourth gear. He was still seeing loose passes and, you know, intercepting in the second half of that game.
I think he's really...
He's a real find, isn't he?
I think he's come on from having Alvarez behind him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where he's had to maybe do that defensive job more often for Southampton.
Yeah.
The shackles are off of him.
He's got a surprisingly good engine, hasn't he?
Yeah,
it's about, and he's no slouch either, is he?
For a sort of floppy Nigel Havers in bright, you know, sort of looks like he could be in Brighthead Revisited. For like a sort of dandy, he's actually quite an engine. He's a
terrific signing.
Terrific.
And he was the furthest man forward against City when he scored that header.
Exactly. You know, I've got quite a few Southampton supporting friends, and they went, you know, he's not just set pieces, he's brilliant. And they're absolutely right. He's absolutely fantastic. Mm. And he does sort of vindicate Moyes' kind of Premier League experience sort of mantra, because he did just come in and immediately behave as if he'd play for this team his whole life, which most, you know, like when Ian Wright came, he just slotted in straight away, Trevor Sinclair, you know. But the second goal was great as well, you know, Emerson's sort of interception wasn't just an interception, it was a pass. And then Antonio's ball was really good.
Souček getting into the box, as he now increasingly is tending to do, like the old days, and a very
three and four games.
I feel
like we've got, now Rice has gone, we've got our Tom back.
Definitely. Yeah. You have to say he had a very good game. Now, it's interesting because we have been really banging the drum that he's probably the one that should make way for a midfield of Paqueta, Ward-Prowse and Alvarez, allowing another attacking player, Kudus or Benrahma, if you're so inclined to play. But it does look like the first choice team now has Paqueta in that left-hand side, that role. Slightly different role, isn't it, to when you play with a Benrahma or a Conor Gallagher there. He's got much more license.
He basically goes wherever he wants.
He's got to do that. It's the only way he can be the player he is.
But it means at times, it puts a little bit of pressure on Emerson to be the wide man on that left. It means at times we're a bit narrow, I think.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We just, I think, have to accept that's the way it's going to be, at least for the foreseeable.
But what's interesting is that Emerson's got sort of free rein down the left, but it's Soufal that's getting the assists this season.
He's playing really well this
season. Bowen's coming more central, and he's taking the defenders with him. I mean, that's three assists in three games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both the Czechs have been really good so far.
Back on it again. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, the obverse of that is that our sort of shittiness in the first half of last season, their loss of form was a huge part of that.
Yeah.
Both Souček and Soufal. Soufal clearly because of that, you know, recovering from that operation he had, which was like a hernia, or was it?
Yeah.
Something, you know,
Soufal, wasn't it, had the operation?
Certainly had.
I think you said Soufal.
You know, was sort of really bad, and people were going, he's rubbish, we should get rid of him. But in fact, you know, the funny thing about last season was that people were going, why did Moyes stick with those guys? And then was sort of vindicated, but possibly very late in the day. But that is Moyes. Moyes is incredibly conservative and slow to change. So, you know, 15 points before Christmas, 25 points after Christmas, because the form of Soufal, Souček and Bowen came back, essentially. So the same players played. I mean, obviously, I think the manager of one of the kind of, you know, the Sky teams would go, right, I'm going to play, you know, Grealish instead of you, Phil Foden, because you've had a drop in your form. Moyes sort of feels he can't do that. I think he might be wrong because Vlasic, you know, sort of ended up sort of being forced out of the team by getting no game time. And, you know, you hope that the same doesn't happen with Kudus.
In an interview with the Evening Standard, Moyes says that Kudus they see as a number 10 / central midfielder.
Or a striker.
Or a centre forward. They don't see him as a wide.
Where I was wondering. That's interesting. Yeah. I wonder.
And he definitely played centrally against Lincoln. He played as a kind of number 10. Mm-hmm. Well, that's where he started, anyway.
In his little cameos, though, he looks fantastic.
Oh, there's been a mazy, thrilling run, hasn't there, so far?
Yeah.
He's got that low centre of gravity.
Yeah.
Really strong with it as well. Special mention for Agüero as well.
Yeah, good. Really good.
Wonderful block he got.
Oh, that block in the second half was fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, there is a sort of, you know, with... and I mean, essentially, it can only really be based on the Europa League game. There's a huge amount of love for Mavropanos, and I think that's right. He was great in that game. But it doesn't mean he immediately displaces Agüero. Funnily enough, the more injury prone Zuma feels like kind of, you know, he might come in to sort of give him a rest, or
that's more likely because they're the two right sided.
Exactly.
And Agüero the left side.
Yeah.
He makes a really good point there that when Ogbonna got injured when he did his knee that time, and we had to play two, Dawson and Zuma, both right-footed, we weren't as good centrally anymore. Hey,
just slightly off the track here. Now you mentioned Craig Dawson. Did you see him against Man?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
I mean, absolutely had Haaland in his pocket.
But that's, you know...
Sniff, and Dawson made three incredible blocks and a clearance off the line.
He's brilliant.
He's superb.
Well, he'd still be here if he didn't want to live for the North. You know, it's completely pragmatic reasons he left the club. There was no falling out, nothing. But yeah, he's terrific. But I think Mavropanos looks like...
He looks like
Craig Dawson.
Really like possibly,
possibly sort of quicker than Craig Dawson.
Yeah, there's some pace there.
Yeah, he's got some athleticism, you know, about him. Yeah, I think he's sort of going to be great.
He used to be a striker, didn't he? I think they said
he did start as a
so he could finish.
Oh, I like the idea.
A bit like his sort of YouTube showreel contains one or two thunderbolts from distance.
Yeah, right. He can strike a ball. As you say, he's very fast.
I like the idea of a centre forward being converted into a centre half. I always thought Andy Carroll should have become a centre half in the latter stages of his career instead of playing for the likes of Reading or wherever he is now.
Well, occasionally Harry Redknapp would, when the team was down to the bare bones, would play Ian Pearce.
Yeah, I was going to say the other way round, yes.
But did he actually play, Harry Redknapp up front in a game?
Yes. Famous.
Goalkeeper.
Played the goalkeeper up front.
Yeah.
I think he was making a point, wasn't he?
But, yeah. But, yeah, so it was a... It was a it, It was a weird game. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, that the foot off the gasness of the second half sort of quietened the home fans. And part of me is sort of thinking, in a 60,000-seater stadium, I mean, I guess Manchester City, you know, they get on such a kind of addictive jag of winning every week. They, in a way, don't mind how they win, you know, because you know, by Christmas, they've had sort of 14 wins or something, you know, and so there's just a kind of party atmosphere. But part of playing in a 60,000-seater stadium, I've always felt the kind of sort of enterprising football rather than soak it up football is what you have to play. You have to play to entertain a kind of huge number of people in a big bowl. You know, you can't play like 1990s Bolton Wanderers or Tony Pulis's Stoke, even though you might end up, you know, a solid ninth in the season. That football will eventually kind of silence your fans.
Yeah, it's a difficult one because in a way, you know, what you saw on Saturday was not the negative football that a lot of, you know, people criticise Moyes for one way or another. It was about controlling a game and thinking about the game in the context of other games that you've got. So it was like kind of, in a way, it was big team mentality to a certain extent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you can't have it both. I mean, you know, in the end, if you're going to be a successful team and you're going to, you know, regularly beat the teams in the bottom half of the, with some ease, the bottom half of the league, you are going to get games where there isn't that jeopardy or that intensity that is what makes it exciting to watch a game. You know, nobody wants a relegation fight, but they often contain much more exciting games. You know, because there's that tension and that.
There was a really interesting interview with Bilic last week, and he was talking about the first season at the new stadium, and he said about, you know, if you'd have interviewed players about, oh, you're going to Upton Park on Monday night, they'd have been dreading it. Oh God, we've got to go to Upton Park on Monday night. So if we moved into that stadium, which is normally that sort of stadium for top four clubs, players were like, this is amazing, this is unreal. Fans were like, God, this is phenomenal stadium, and we didn't have the squad to match the stadium.
No.
So he said, in some ways, he actually, the first season, although it wasn't great, they stayed up. He's quite proud of that season because of the adversity they had of moving in there, the fans being against it, the players that
were displaced community, and it was and no one felt really comfortable with it.
Wasn't.
We also had the most appalling transfer window that summer, and you know, all five players he signed were absolute dog shit.
Dreadful.
And,
dreadful.
We eventually lost money on a lot of that. There was that too, and I think Bilic was a great national coach, but has not really had any success at club level at all since.
I mean, that one, the last season, that emotional season, that with some of the lone players we had and Payet firing, you know, it was
just all
clicked. Brilliant, wasn't it?
It was amazing,
thrillingly good season, you know. And then did fall turn to dust, really, didn't it?
You know, I thought I'm going to raise it again, but Bilic going and doing that punditry for the Euros that year, that immediately sort of sent, you know, a shiver down my spine. It's like, what are you doing? We're migrating to this new unfamiliar stadium and you're just going on a sort of jolly for like a month in fucking wherever the Euros were that year. It's like, get on the phone, buy some fucking new players. What is wrong with you? It really made me furious. And like his knee slide on the desk when Payet scored a goal. He's scoring it for France. He's not scoring it for fucking West Ham. And in fact, that very player was the one that pulled his rug from out under him the next season. It's like, don't fanboy over one of your fucking players. You're the boss, not Dimitri fucking Payet. And, you know, and that bunch of that shower of Jonathan Caleri, Gökhan Töre, Fagüli, Ashley Fletcher, the Swiss guy.
Fernandez.
They were just
Nordfight.
Awful.
Nordfight.
Awful.
Yeah.
The most, they were like championship standard footballers, all of them. Fagüli, I thought, was the only one that tried.
He was okay. He was good. But,
well,
but
he was the one that went, we're shit, I'm going to try it. So when he came on, because he quite often came on, he ran Marlon Harewood like at the other team's goal. At least he fucking tried. And went on to have a, you know, the rest of his career in Turkey. I don't know where he went back. He, you know, he's was a good player.
I still remember him sort of standing aside and waving Andy Robertson through just for Hull City. That away game, just the most appalling piece of just, do come and score. Well, make yourself at home in our penalty box.
Yeah.
Please score against us.
But, you know, this week coming up, we have, you know, partially. It's funny that I slightly thought that Suchet playing in the game against Lincoln for I think 90 minutes might have hinted at resting him for the weekend, where we might see a Kudus based front three, and then Paqueta, Ward-Prowse and Alvarez behind them. Nope, plays the whole game on Saturday, I think.
It's
his favourite player, but he works him like a sort of Victorian child in a factory.
Yeah.
It's like on 16-hour days.
It's with Antonio, really. I mean, he could have been given a rest, taken off at half-time or subbed after 10 minutes in the second half, because he was clearly flagging.
Yeah.
And it really showed with the one chance, golden chance we had in the second half when... I think was it Benrahma cut the ball back to him?
And
he didn't seem to notice.
Didn't realise he wasn't ready. Yeah. No, I mean, I still. It's when your team can't score that you're in trouble. And you know, last season I'm really, really conscious of, like, we have scored 13 goals in seven games, and that's a very good rate, nearly two per game. But I still want to really know that hoodoo is over, that we can't score goals, because I you're just dead in the water if you can't score, dead in the water. And I still feel I want that kind of Bowen, Antonio, Kudus front three to like start a game and see how they can get on, see how they get on, because this Kudus guy has got to sort of feel like he's the future, because he does feel like he's literally young compared to, you know, I think Antonio. You know, if Antonio's like 32, he's 23.
Yeah.
It's like, he's the kind of the opposite of Antonio's age. You've got to say that someone is the future, and you've got to sort of embrace the fact that someone on his last game for Ajax scored three goals, then scored two in the international break, then came to your team, and you go, well, I don't think he'll settle
in. It's not
fit enough.
It's looking like it's going to be, you know, Antonio will have to displace rather than Suchet.
Yeah.
And Suchet's... what's it, 3 and 4, and he's as we said looking good. So
I've seen Paqueta get a little bit frustrating with Antonio in the last
squared one to Antonio
and then he
had a great chance just to slide. Paqueta made a great run outside him where he had that shot that went wide. He just
was that against Manchester City?
There's
one where he literally yelled at him. I think it was Man City. Where like he put just put it absolutely
on a plate,
on a sixpence for him to score, and he just miscontrolled it and just first touch too heavy, and he just yelled at him, just, you know, what do I have to do. Yeah, I mean, I think
it must be very frustrating to play with a player like
Antonio. I can remember Antonio and Allaire sort of as a front two. Allaire is just assist city for Antonio to put it in the net. Nothing comes back from Antonio to him. There was a 2-yard pass in the penalty area to Allaire to tap it in. Antonio managed to kick it 1 yard. managed to under-hit a two-yard pass.
There was an identical opportunity. Yeah. We'd be charging through. Antonio had the ball. He had I can't remember, he had players on his left and his right. He took it on and he blasted it, I think, straight at the goalkeeper.
But then for all those,
for all those,
you can remember the amazing interchange of passes that led to the Paqueta's goal against Liverpool last season. You remember his really clever assist for Suchek's equaliser against Spurs. You remember his amazing bullying the centre-half and then sliding the ball through for Bowen at Lyon. You know, he can do that great things.
I think the thing about him, if you are a sort of very pragmatic football manager, the thing I think about Antonio, and you know, I do like him. He does do great things, and he is a kind of he's a wild card, but we can only afford sort of one wild card. Yeah. That's partly why I don't think Benrahma, who doesn't have enough end product, and Mikel Antonio, who doesn't have enough end product, can be in the same team. The thing about Antonio is that he does cost you points when he's not getting you points.
Yeah.
He gets you points, but there are times like, you know, just those twice against Palace, that sort of just cross, just dabbing it bafflingly to the goalkeeper in the dying minutes of the game, who kicks it up to the pitch and then Palace score a goal. Twice. He did it twice. You know, it's like, just kick it out of play. You know, you literally gave the ball back to the opposition and they scored. Why did you do that?
It's a
square ball to Andre Ayew against, I think, Swansea. I keep bringing this example up. But, I mean, they're just running up the pitch parallel to each other. He's just got to kick it 2 yards to Andre Ayew. He just kicks it straight at, I think, Lucas Fabianski, as he's lying on the deck, just kicks. He goes down. He's even gone down. He could dink it over Fabianski, but he just kicks it into his midriff. Tamely kicks it into his midriff. 2 yards to his right is Andre Ayew, completely unmarked. That's a goal. And we ended up, you know, like drawing instead of winning, or possibly losing instead of drawing that game. And it's like, I don't think I've seen a player that literally costs you points in moments that you can see, you know, to counteract the points he gets you. You know, like good players, if they're having a shit game, at least they don't cost you points, you know. They just run around and fail to score goals, you know.
He does really unnerve defenders there. I mean, he's a unique player in that sense that we laugh and we don't know what he's going to do. No one knows. No. Least of all him himself.
And
you can see the defenders trying to read him.
Yeah.
And his physicality, because he's got that incredible upper body strength and power. And he's still got quite a bit of pace.
Changed the game against the Serbs, didn't it, when he came on?
Yes.
Although he didn't actually end up assisting or scoring, it changed the dynamic of it all.
But that's why I think, you know, like, you know, what I've sort of been saying since the beginning of the season and during last season is that in a front three, at least one of the front three has got to be better, if not two, you know? And Benrahma, Antonio and Bowen... Bowen's the only really good one. You know, the other two are like sort of mavericks. You can only have one maverick in the front three, you know, like...
Yeah. But it's the chaos that makes football a very enjoyable sport.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to talk about this before. You know my hatred of Manchester City and their boring... I think they're really boring to watch because it's almost like they've cracked the code of football.
Mm.
It's like an algorithm that will just destroy you. They will keep the ball, they'll hold on to, they'll have 77% possession, maybe more, and they'll just wear the opposition out, come towards your penalty area. And even if it takes them 45, 50, 60 minutes, they will eventually find a small gap in your penalty area and score win. And then there'll be 2-3 up, and then there'll be 25 minutes having to be played out for everybody.
Mm.
There was a really good article in the Sunday Times yesterday about this guy called Tony Munoz, who's the owner of... Union Saint-Gilles, the Brussels team, who have now made it into the Champions League from being a third division team, and his relationship with Tony Bloom, the Brighton owner. And this guy, Tony Munoz, is sort of a number cruncher, a sort of a kind of whiz kid, and he joined a company called Starlink, which is Tony Bloom's betting algorithm system. And he's a data geek, so he started, you know, registering assists and throw-ins and kicks and stuff, building up data, and went into this business in a big way. And he said, actually, I made note of it, that the whole thing about data in American sports is with
it's like the Moneyball.
Yeah, Moneyball was in basketball and baseball. Analytics have driven efficiency to the point of making the game boring.
Yeah,
everyone is playing the same way. Everyone has figured out the things to do and the things not to do. And in baseball, they've worked out that bunting is bad, which is bunting, if you don't know what it is, yeah. I looked it up, it's where you just literally, instead of hitting the ball really hard a long way out of the
field, you drop it in front of you and
run. Just tap it.
It's like
run.
Tip and run.
And instead of going to the first, it's like the way we play rounders at school.
So let's explain that to me.
Bunting.
Sorry, you were speaking at the same time.
Bunting is literally, instead of really hitting the ball very hard, which is what you try and do, it's literally tapping it.
Right.
For a few feet in front of you, so you run to the first base, and whoever's on the first base gets to second base.
Second base, yeah.
So they work out that that's kind of not a great way to win a game. Stealing bases is bad, and that if you want home runs, and if you want home runs or get struck out, do you know what baseball fans hate? Home runs and strikeouts. What really fans really want is the running between bases, the throws coming in, and the chaos.
Both
basketball and baseball in America have become so analysed when they set their teams up, they pick their players and they coach them, they've become very boring for the fans to watch.
Yeah.
And that was always the thing I was saying about Manchester City, is like, have they really figured out how to play football better than anybody else in the world? And if that started to become somehow was duplicated, I know you see a lot of teams trying to play.
I think
completely dull and boring.
I mean, I think Pep, you know, like Mourinho was considered to be sort of very boring, but like Mourinho's just, I think the players' skills, you know, when there is Edin Dzeko and there is, you know, Zola, and you know, I know they probably, these people might not have played under Mourinho,
but you've got
people that are entertaining to watch in a system that might be kind of, you know, a bit sort of flat. So actually, you know, if you were to subscribe to an idea that Moyes ball is boring, actually our two goals on Saturday were really well crafted goals that required sort of skill and talent. You know, I mean, I guess that is the thing about those sort of people that are saying that, you know, Pep's cracked the code, Mourinho's cracked the code, is that they have teams with like skillful players that are entertaining to watch.
Well, Manchester City not only have a team of world class players, they've got a second and third team.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that's sort
so
of probably
do
more about
things
it.
That are easy on the eye. You know, Kevin De Bruyne and Phil Foden will do things that are kind of easy on the eye. And I think, you know, Pacatar's like, you know, little things he does are worth the price of the ticket. Yeah. And you go, you know, it's great that he's playing for us. It is, you know, it is very ironic that because of like the resurgence of Czech international Thomas Suchek, Brazilian international Lucas Pacatar now has to play in an unfamiliar position to accommodate Thomas Suchek coming back into some form. Brazil's central midfielder Lucas Pacatar has to play in a position he doesn't really want to play in. You know,
I think football's saving grace is it's so difficult to score in football. And a lot of the games you're commenting about, basketball for us, are very easy to score, isn't it? So basically, most attacks should end in a basket.
Yeah.
In basketball.
Well, the basket should be now.
They should have put it further up.
15, 18 feet in the air now.
Smaller than the ball.
And I think that means it's very difficult. However good you are and however dominant you are, as you know, the game against Wolves showed with Man City, that you are going to come up against times where you don't just get that space in the box.
Absolutely.
And you don't quite win. You know, we beat Sheffield United comfortably 2-0. I watched the game against Man City, and Sheffield United, admittedly, they were at home, but they were very unlucky to lose against Man City, and Man City huffed and puffed and could not break them down. So, for most of the game. And, you know, to take the Rugby World Cup which there are so many games in that cup where the team that is better simply steamrollers the other team. So there are games that are finishing 90-0 and 70-0.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't happen. That equivalent thing rarely happens at a football World Cup, where Saudi Arabia can beat Germany and those shocks come, because it's so difficult to score a goal, and one goal can and you can defend
by margin
one goal lead. Yeah, it's
no, yeah. Football is a very bulletproof sport. Isn't yeah. it? It's yeah. like you know, rugby needs tweaks to its rules all the time because you know I don't know people sort of seem to. Find ways of sort of bending the rules to cheat, so they sort of stop that, and then you know, like scrums collapsing and all that sort of bullshit. Whereas football stays fairly consistent all the time, and when you think there are ways to dominate it, that sort of doesn't happen. You know, there was that period when, sort of in the 90s, early noughties, when. We remarked on it, didn't we, that sort of championship teams were actually beating Premier League teams in the FA Cup with skill. You know, yeah, Tubby yeah, Little, that yeah. guy that used to play for Sunderland.
Yeah, Reed.
Reed, Andy yeah, Reed. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like running rings around Arsenal's very athletic, 6'2" kind of team at the time, because athleticism and endurance had suddenly become the vogue in the Premier League. And actually, these teams will start to get turned over. So then everyone became like Eden Hazard. Everyone's tiny. Santi Cazorla, Eden Hazard, David Silva. Everyone became little again. You know, so the game goes in waves because actually it's bulletproof.
And everyone's looking for the new thing.
Or
formations as well. Yeah. You've gone from 4-4-2 to wing-backs to one big man up top and now three up top.
But you don't have to change the basic game. Yeah. It's like tennis. Tennis always fucking works.
You know.
When they thought the big serve, when, you know, like Buster Mottram and Andy Roddick and those, you know, there was another American guy came on with it, enormous serves. You went, the game's fucked now. You know, and I remember McEnroe as a pundit saying something's got to be done, we've got to change it to just one serve, or he went one serve or go back to wooden rackets. It's like this the only way. This game is now dead. Then post rehab, Andre Agassi came back and could get everyone's serve back. He could just get it back. The bald, shaven-headed Andre Agassi, he's probably like, you know, well, he started when he was really young, so he's probably only about 28, but a veteran just came back and could just get it back.
Yeah.
And then other people went, oh, we can get this big serve back. And then the game settled back down again. Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah.
Two things there. One is I think tennis is so much about psychology and you know, and you see, watching tennis is great because you just see someone's losing confidence.
Yeah.
But the same in football. You can see, like,
you've definitely. About,
if we had conceded a goal, even in the 87th minute against Sheffield United, and one of them gone in, you have that collective consciousness where everyone's shitting themselves.
Yeah.
And it upsets.
Yeah.
It spreads to the team. I think that's the team feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's one of the key.
Psychology is hard in football, I think. Yeah. You know, you see nervy games.
Absolutely.
Confident games.
And the jeopardy of it being so difficult to score and that one goal completely turn a game contributes to that, doesn't it? The knowledge that, okay, so we're 2-0 up, but they get a goal back and the momentum shifts to them. And you know, it's not like you can, you know, let the other team score a try when you're 80-0 up in the run. It doesn't kind of matter, does it? And you're right that there are, you know, systems and analysis of formations and all that kind of thing. But however brilliantly you've organised your formation system, somebody can just pile drive one in from 40 yards. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no legislating for that, is there?
And VAR's added to that as well.
Yeah.
It'd be 1-0 up, score the second, it gets ruled out, all of a sudden the other team...
Absolutely. What you say about tennis, because the scoring system in tennis helps it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because so often a lot of the points are not as important as this... crucial point now.
Actually,
you can win more points than your opponent and still lose a tennis match.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that helps
points.
It.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Hugely psychological. I mean, the part of, you know, I mean, we're only 7 games in and things are looking sort of pretty good at the moment. But I did think, you know, and I've said this before, after all the kind of discontent, certainly on social media in the summer, about sort of, you know, the acquisition guy hates Moyes, there's all this sort of stuff, the club's a basket case. When we got to Bournemouth a little late and I went, we came up the stairs and the game had started, and you looked at the players and you went, the last thing these guys did is win a European trophy. And they were, the game was, you know, already underway, and I sort of thought, oh, Suchet's playing well. Yeah, Suchet's playing. Yeah, so it's good. You went, this is a good outfit. This outfit should actually intimidate, you know, 2/3 of the teams in the division. They go, you know, you've got Lucas Paquetá, James Ward-Prowse plays for them now. He didn't in that game. But, you know, it's actually Bowen is like probably the most kind of informed striker in the league at the moment. It's like,
well, you said, Phil, we had
Watkins
15 points by Christmas last year, or by the World Cup. Got 13
already. Yeah, exactly.
Totally different start to the season.
Take our foot off the gas.
Well, with City losing, we're back in the title.
Well, the next two games are the most interesting acid test of the season so far, aren't they? Because they are. They're not against the traditional top three or four, but they are against teams that are challenging for that top four, five, six. Technically, they're the most direct rivals now we have, probably along with possibly Brighton. You could chuck in there, Newcastle, Villa, and I think that, you know, whatever we get out of those games might be a clear indication of where we're headed long term.
Yeah,
season.
I did.
So they, Newcastle actually could potentially be missing two very good players from Sunday as well. So Botman is out, and they reckon that Gordon might be out, who has been in very good form.
Yeah.
They still have.
Hansy Gordon.
But they've got a few injury problems. They're losing Joe Linton.
Joe Linton's injured, and I think there's a couple of late fitness tests.
They've got one or two injury problems.
And what's the name's out, isn't he? Harvey Barnes is out for months.
Who's their... are they travelling on Wednesday? Who have they got in the Champions League? Do we know? They must be at home, because they travel to Milan.
PSG
at home. Yeah.
Welcome, Kylian Mbappé. Come down, big market.
They've got an extra day.
Mbappé is like a word designed for people from the northeast to say. Mbappé.
Big and Mbappé.
Before we talk about Freiburg and Newcastle, we should mark a very special occasion that occurred yesterday in West Ham's history, which is the 30-something birthday of Ricardo Vaz Tay, one of the great West Ham players, up there with Bonds, Brooking. For me, he's both Jim and I coincidentally looked at his showreel of goals on YouTube today.
Yeah.
They're fucking great. Really, really, you know, again, like Ravel Morrison's period with West Ham, it was like wrong manager, right player. You know, it's like, Vaz Tay, once we got into the Premier League and he signed Andy Carroll, it was difficult for other strikers to get into the team. And like Sacco, I mean, both Sacco and Vaz Tay were riven with injuries. Vaz Tay had big injury problems. Followed him for the rest of his career after he left us, you know. You know, he had problems, but he was a really good player, Vaz.
Yeah, was it the hat-trick against Blackpool?
Brighton.
The overhead kick.
Scored against Blackpool. Yeah. Scored in one of
the games. Smashed in that seemed to just... It went through the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Where did he go to? Where did we... Anybody remember where he went off to?
Well, he went to Turkey for a while. He played for Charlton. After he left us, I think he might have gone to Turkey from us and then came back and played for John. He played for a couple of Chinese teams.
You do love him, Phil.
And then he went.
You really do love him.
And then he went back to the world of jazz funk.
Absolutely. What a player! Yeah, he was a great player. He's one of those, you know, like It was a shame, both for Vazte and Sacco, that they sort of struggle with injuries so much, and also actually with the manager that you know, when Andy Carroll played, were just displaced.
Yeah. He's forever going to be a cult hero, isn't he?
Yeah.
We should, for the sake of balance, remind ourselves that it is also the great Sir Trevor Brookings' birthday today, I believe.
Oh, is it today?
75.
Not as good as Vazte, though, was he?
Yesterday. Wow. That's his boots.
Yes, Sir Trevor Brooking.
Yeah.
There's a player.
There is a player.
You know, fantastic. What a footballer he was. And did get enough love from England. You know, unlike Bonzo, who didn't. Brooking.
Yeah,
you know,
he did.
Maybe not enough games for England, but.
Yeah, well, I wonder how. About 60? Played about 60 times for England, something like that.
So maybe fallow England period, wasn't it? It was an era where we wouldn't drop.
I mean, one suspects, though, that it helped that Greenwood was the manager for part of that time, wasn't it? And knew how good he was.
I
remember he scored the goal in that game in Hungary, where the ball got stuck.
In the stanchion. This is the first time you really heard the word stanchion said out loud. Because whoever the commentator, David Coleman, whoever the commentator was, kept saying stanchion. Like, stop saying stanchion all the time. Vazte, you know, he's a real cult hero for me. Samasiabu.
He scored the goal that got us promoted.
Absolutely, and what a goal that was. Happened right in front of us, obviously, away fan second half. But, from our steep angle, it looks like he's hitting it over.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's in the roof of the net, and you're like, fucking hell. I mean, you know, that's one of the great, great celebrations.
Oh, God,
you know.
That was a great day. Absolutely brilliant.
Fantastic, yeah.
Suchek in the home tie against Seville.
Yes.
Took the roof off that fucking stadium when that goal went in. And Bowen in Prague. I mean, that was...
I'd have loved to have been there, wasn't there? I'd love to have been there for Pablo in Alkmaar, though. That was another... I was jumping around my living room.
You'd have been fighting them as they came up the stands.
I'd have gone low, though. Not a high.
Set of keys in your hand.
Yeah, low.
When you say low, do you mean you'd be at the bottom of the stairs instead of the top of the stairs, like Knowlesy?
No. Well, possibly.
You'd have put a kind of velvet rope up and said, do you have a ticket to run up the stairs?
I would have done.
People who want to be punched by Knowlesy, queue on the left. Guest list, queue on the right. People that want to meet Paqueta's wife, on the right. People that want to be punched by Knowlesy, on the left. But yes, we are going to play mid-table Bundesliga Freiburg.
Yeah, you know,
they're like
though.
Ninth or something in that division. They're above the team that knocked us out of the Europa League last time. They're above Eintracht Frankfurt, so I think that is going to be.
Do you think he'll change all 11 again?
No, I doubt it. I bet you Suchet plays. I think obviously Fabianski looks like he's the European Cup goalkeeper.
Mm-hmm. Play that defence.
I suspect Kehrer might play it right back.
Yeah, and I'm sure Ogbonna and Mavropanos will play. But
Cresswell's injured.
But he wants something out of that, doesn't he? I mean, I think
Johnson was all right at Lincoln. I mean, but it's a bit.
They're tough. So I mean, it feels like he.
I agree. I think this is the crunch. In any way, it's the crunch game, isn't it? Because you fancy getting something against anybody at home in Europe these days.
It's not. It's,
get something there, win there, 6 points on the board. Looking pretty.
Yeah.
I just kind of hope I'm one of them ones where I'd like to see Kudos play with our first team. From the start, rather than in play with Fornals and Benrahma and that, and then when it comes to the actual Premier League game, he comes on for 10 or 15 minutes and you think he's got to get used to playing with Paqueta.
I think he may well play Kudus, given his interview in the Standard. I think he might start
on Thursday.
He might start.
I think he will, but it isn't just a case of our sort of second 11 Standard, you know, non-Premier League team, because it's a tough fixture and you don't want to like lose it. It would be great, you know, to do our best and because they're going to be tough. So it's really difficult with Newcastle coming up at the weekend.
Whether he'll just rest Bowen and play Kudos on the right.
He might. Yes.
Benny on the left.
Yes.
He might.
Yeah.
I think Paqueta will play, you know.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he's super fit, isn't he? I mean, yeah. You know, it feels like he's...
he wants to play.
And he's
got that look about
him. He's got a good engine.
Yeah, he does. Play.
I mean, these, you know, like, the good thing about our fancy Dans is that they actually do have good engines, like Ward Prowse, who you just thought would, like, you know, want to faint into a sedan chair after 60 minutes of just playing free kicks and... have, you know, those sort of fronds waved over him like sultans. But he doesn't. He plays, he works really hard, as does Paqueta. But, yeah, you know, I mean, our second 11, you know, he might find a way to include Fornals against Freiburg. Certainly get game time.
He might pay Dinos and
Oggy
save Zuma's knees for Newcastle.
Yeah,
I think they are managing Zuma, aren't they?
Yeah,
he's got the Ledley Kings about him, isn't he?
But we're now confident that Maropoulos can do that job. I mean,
it looks really good.
That's looking really good.
Yeah,
it looks really good.
Should 5:45 kickoff though as well.
Yes.
Yes. Early.
Yes.
Six.
Yes.
Yeah. 6:45 kickoff, is it?
Yeah, 5:45.
Should we perhaps wrap this up by doing predictions for those two games?
Yeah.
Freiburg 1-1.
I'll be a bit more optimistic. 1-0 to us, keeping our clean sheets.
I'm going for a goalless draw.
Ooh, intriguing.
I think it's going to be a
beat. I'm going to go 2-1 West Ham.
2-1 West Ham. Excellent. Now Newcastle on Sunday.
Newcastle.
Different kettle of fish.
2-2. Yeah. 1-1.
they've got some injury problems. I think they'll want to dominate the ball. I think they'll be confident. They're on a very, very good run. 2-0 West Ham.
Nice.
Bold.
Pete?
I'm going to go all guns blazing. 3-2. West Ham.
Nice. I like it.
I think it might be a good game to watch.
So do I. Yes, it could be. Yeah. It could be.
We score the winner in the 114th minute.
That's offside.
Yeah.
But VAR lets it stand.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be the ideal modern game of football outcome. I mean, fucking VAR this weekend. I mean, it's just like, sort of officiating's gone a bit mad, hasn't it? I think the sort of... I mean, pundits were being really openly rebellious and mean about it the last couple of years. But I think, you know, some of the games this season have been kind of the worst it's ever been. That sort of, you know, vertically cleared ball that we were talking about on last week's podcast that then glances the player's hand as it's heading towards fucking Saturn, you know, and they go, that's handball. It's already been cleared by the guy's foot. And then it's just glance. They just don't know what they're doing anymore.
I think that's the problem.
It's not with handball.
Not with handball, no.
The technology's not broken. It's the human part of it, and the interpretation's broken.
Exactly.
Yes, actually,
you have to get your system right. How are you going to use the technology that's available to you? And there are sports that have common sense, tried and trusted now, systems whereby that technology is used, possibly easier to use it in, say, cricket, but it still works, and there's an absolute clear protocol, even down to the kind of the words that the third umpire says as he goes through a process of assessing the appeal of one. And it's a mess. If the person who's reviewing in the VAR thinks the wrong field decision is a different one to the one that's actually that's a massive system fuck up, isn't
it? Yeah, because it's just overturning a clear and obvious error. Yeah. And what it's become is like someone in Stockley Park goes, I disagree with your decision. Yeah, just disagreement. Lovely. And you like go, well, that's just a ship of fucking fools then. Mm-hmm. You know, that happens, you know, like in my field of work, sort of writing scripts, is what will sometimes happen is that you've got two ideas about how the script could develop. So what someone, you know, at the top goes is, well, let's develop both scripts. And you go, no, let's make one script really good, because we go all the way with two scripts. You're like, well, you've got to fucking film one of these things. It's someone going, could we just have all the ideas in this thing? And then when they go, lights, camera, action, will magically decide on one of these scripts. It's like, no, you've got to just keep improving one fucking script. That whole thing of going, on-field referee thinks this, Stockley Park goes, oh, no, I don't think that's right, I think it should be this. That way lies mad.
I thought they were going to introduce semi-automatic offsides, because really, if you took out the human interpretation bit, and that's basically you're drawing a line, or a computer can draw a line, and it can tell you that is quite clearly offside, is foots in front of the other player. And that was the case on Saturday, whenever that game was. And so having humans to then, like your point you're making, having humans to overturn it is a nonsense, because the technology should be trusted enough, certainly in those clear-cut decisions, like offside is just a line, where you could remove all of that heartache and problems by just saying, it's like in cricket, with Hawkeye, you know it's there's been a nick, they've got that sound thing. So I don't think they're using the technology correctly.
No, it's very strange. I mean, there was a game, I don't know whether it was last season or two seasons ago, where there was a decision, we scored, and 4 minutes later we had was it handball? Was there offside? Was there a free kick involved? And in the end, the goal got disallowed because it touched Antonio's shoelace on the goal line.
Yeah.
But yet, in some of those games, they're making a decision in 5 seconds. And you're like, what's going on here? Why has one decision taken you 4 minutes and the other one you've made a decision in 10 seconds? I just don't understand it.
I think those vertical lines from shoulders to the ground on those kind of replays that you see on Match of the Day. I mean, you know, like that thing with sprint races, that the reason they dip at the end is that it's your chest breaking the line. Yeah. They don't go, oh, his fingernails go. Yeah, exactly. Everyone would run doing a kind of Hitler salute if it was literally just the first part of your body to cross the line. You know, people would just like get arm extensions. They be in traction to increase their arm. It's not. It's kind of like, you know, it's whether the bulk of you is in front of the defender, I think.
It's like Lee Evans used to say, didn't he, with the horse racing. He said, you never see in the photo finish the jockey leaning over the horse like that. Everyone knows it's on the nose.
But that's, you know, it's become insane. Anyway, it's a down note to end on, but this has been Stop Hammer Time. My name is Phil Whelans. With me this week being Jim Grant.
Cheerio.
Pete Ward.
Goodbye.
Pete Harcourt.
Thank you for having me.
Come on, you irons.
If you want to advertise on or sponsor this show, check us out at playbackmedia.co.uk.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.